She's worked for numerous agencies, including Environmental Protection Agency, the Forest Service, the City of Seattle, the Washington Environmental Council, and she also worked for the Suquamish Indian Tribe, where she developed their fish habitat protection program. Her master's thesis was entitled Evaluating the Effectiveness of Stormwater Policies in Protecting Streams, and those of you in this area, this is really an important and hot topic right now, is how do we manage stormwater and how do we take into consideration fish habitat and aquatic habitat. She now works for the National Marine Fisheries Service over here by Sandpoint, and she's a stormwater lead for the Washington State Habitat Office. Let's offer a warm welcome to Deanne Kirkpatrick.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here this morning. As Ann mentioned, I'm going to be talking about stormwater and how to manage stormwater for healthy populations in Puget Sound. And I'm going to cover this topic by talking first about how stormwater affects salmon, then about how stormwater is managed in the Puget Sound area, and then what we think an ideal stormwater management program to protect salmon would include. So what is the problem of stormwater for salmon? The main effects are on stream hydrology, geomorphology, and water quality. And as you can imagine, this shouldn't be too much of a surprise, as historically we had primarily forested conditions that covered the landscape. And now in many places we've changed these to very hard surfaces that we don't have very much natural vegetation in the landscape. We don't have many wetlands, or there's not many natural soils left to absorb the rainfall. So if you look at this graphic, you can see the hydrologic cycle, how it changes before and after construction. Before the land's developed, a lot of the rainfall is intercepted by trees and returned back to the air through evapotranspiration. And then also a great deal goes into the groundwater, either as interflow or as base flow, which later provides flow to the nearby streams. So under this scenario, very little of the runoff runs off the land as surface runoff. As compared to the after-construction scenario, where you have a lot more hard surfaces like buildings, parking lots, sidewalks, driveways, and under this scenario, most of the surface runoff just runs directly off the land. And a much smaller amount is evapotranspired back into the air or has an opportunity to soak into the groundwater. So that what might lead people to think that stormwater is just an urban problem because that's where they have all the impervious surfaces. But this graph shows that that's clearly not the case, with stormwater discharges on the vertical axis in time across on the horizontal axis. You can see that clearly the greatest stormwater discharge comes from the urban environment, but there's also a change in the runoff pattern from even agricultural practices, mixed agricultural and forest land use, and also from forest land uses. And if you look at what this means for stream flow rates, you can see from this graph that there's a change between the pre-development scenario, which is in the dashed line, and the post-development, which is in the solid line. And so with stream flow rate on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis, you see under the pre-development scenario that you start with a higher base flow amount, and after a storm event, it rises gradually to a peak flow and then descends gradually to a higher base flow. Whereas under the post-development scenario, you start with a lower groundwater level, and after a storm event, you have very quickly rising peak flow events and very dramatically short falling down to the base flow level, which is lower than under pre-development conditions. And as I mentioned, this can lead to reduced base flows because there isn't any stormwater.
Technical difficulty.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Is it possible to vamp for a bit while we try to set up the projector kind of over here?
Possible to do what?
Vamp for a bit.
Just talk?
Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. So if you caught the picture before it went off the screen, it was a picture of a stream channel that didn't have any water flow in it. And that can happen under extreme conditions because in an urbanized environment, particularly all the runoff is running off the land during the winter storm flow events, and none of it is getting into the groundwater. So during the summer, when normally that groundwater would be feeding the base flow of the stream, there's no water left to put into the stream. And so, as you can imagine, this kind of scenario is very bad for salmon if there's no water in the stream during the summer when they need to be there. Another thing that can happen, in addition to changes to stream hydrology, are changes to the geomorphology of the stream. And that means that the habitat can be changed by the salmon because the particle size of the substrate in the stream changes from what historically was probably gravel, which is very suitable for salmon habitat, and it changes to larger substrate particles like cobbles and boulders because that's the size of material that can withstand high flows. The other thing that happens is if there was riparian vegetation next to the stream, that can be removed by high flows also that erode the stream channel, and you lose that leaf litter into the stream. You increase the amount of sunlight going into the stream, and it changes the food resources for fish. It also can cause a lot of erosion of the stream channel. When you have additional flows in the channel, it erodes the banks and either causes the channel to downcut, making it deep and narrow, or to widen out, making it more shallow and wide. And in this particular case, there aren't any pools in the stream channel for fish.
Do you mind if I move the laptop over here, get a little more range?
Sure. So I was saying, one of the things that can happen is you can get extremely downcut channels that don't provide any fish habitat for fish because they're so narrow, and oftentimes they're so far away from the stream banks that they're not getting that overhanging vegetation. And I have an example that I wanted to show you here when we get back to that. Okay. That looks good. Is that okay for people in the back of the room? Okay. So, as I was mentioning, in addition to the effects to the hydrology, there's also effects to stream geomorphology, and they include channel erosion, changing the size of the substrate in the stream, and changing the amount of energy that gets to the stream. And here's that example that I wanted to show you of an extremely downcut channel. This is a stream in Federal Way that's been downcut because of the addition of stormwater flows to this little stream channel. And also, you can imagine the alternate scenario in some condition, some streams where they have a lot of cobbles or hard surface on the stream bed. Instead of down cutting, the stream channel will cut out to the side and create a very shallow channel that doesn't have any pools for fish. So there are also stormwater effects to the water quality of the stream, and among those is changing the natural temperature regime of the stream, and this includes having higher water temperatures in the summer, which can be too high for fish to be successful in that environment, and they can also be lower water temperatures in the winter, which affect the fish's metabolism. And also, in addition to this water quality effect, is our increased levels of pollutants that are washing off the landscape. And this became a big issue, especially about 4 years ago, when this story was on the front page of the Seattle PI. It was titled, "Our Troubled Sound, Spawning Coho Dying Early in Restored Creeks." And a quote from that article stated that water in many urban streams is dirty enough to kill coho salmon. And this is the adult coho salmon. And they said, even at that time, 4 years ago, that the culprit appeared to be stormwater. And since that time, scientists at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center have been further studying this issue. They're finding that there are overt stormwater effects on salmon, like the pre-spawning mortality, where the coho salmon come upstream to spawn, and before they have an opportunity to deposit their eggs in the gravel, they die. But they're also finding there are more subtle effects on salmon, particularly on juvenile salmon. For example, copper is a very common metal in urban stormwater, and we know at very high concentrations it can be very lethal. But even at low concentrations, we're finding now that it can be a neurotoxin to fish. It can wipe out the sensory function, including a fish's sense of smell. And you might not understand how important this is for fish, but for fish, that's a way for them to detect predators in their environment. It allows them to detect motion in the area around them. And this is an example. It shows the lateral line, the sensory neurons in a zebra fish that can be completely wiped out by very low levels of copper. So in their recent studies, they're finding that for juvenile salmon, they can show an 8 to 57% reduction in their ability to avoid predators. And this is at very low copper levels, 0.18 to 2.1 micrograms per liter. They're also studying other water quality pollutants, like other metals like lead and zinc. They're looking at polyaromatic hydrocarbons that come from the burning of fossil fuels. They're also looking at pesticides, particularly ones that are used for lawns and gardens and maintenance of roadsides and golf courses. And they're also looking at the combination of pollutants. And all these effects, the effects to hydrology, geomorphology, and water quality, are made worse by the loss of riparian and upland forests throughout the watershed. And these together result in declines in the invertebrate species that the fish rely on for prey, and also in a reduction of fish species diversity. So against that background of what stormwater effects are, I wanted to tell you about current stormwater management in the Puget Sound area. It's pretty complex. It's managed at different levels of government. And at the top, at the federal level, there's the Environmental Protection Agency. And then at the state level, there's the Department of Ecology. At a regional level, we have the Puget Sound Water Quality Management Plan that was put together by what was historically called the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority. And then at the local level, the city, county, and level, you have local governments managing stormwater. So at the federal level, EPA, under the Clean Water Act, sets the national guidelines and standards for the issuance of what are called National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES permits. And in this state, at least, this responsibility for issuing permits has been delegated from EPA to the state. And then the state issues permits to municipal governments, to industrial facilities like sewage treatment facilities or pulp and paper mills, and to construction sites. And ecology's main role in this is developing stormwater manuals. So back in 1992, they developed their first stormwater manual as described by the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority. And then in 2001, they updated their manual. And then again in 2005, they issued two manuals, one for Eastern Washington and one for Western Washington. So the Puget Sound Water Quality Management Plan specified that all jurisdictions in the Puget Sound area should come up with comprehensive stormwater programs, and they should base these programs on the manuals that Ecology developed. So with all this regulatory framework, you might think that stormwater should be fairly well managed in the state. However, there are significant gaps in the way that stormwater is managed. And the first one is that it relies primarily on water quality criteria to manage stormwater, and that does not necessarily address the needs, the biological needs of salmon or their habitat needs. A researcher here at the University of Washington, Jim Carr, wrote a paper several years ago that talked about water quality criteria not addressing the water quantity effects. So, I mean, we know that water quantity affects the hydrology and the geomorphology, and if those effects aren't addressed, we're not going to be very successful in protecting salmon. It also doesn't address water quality issues very well for a couple of reasons. It doesn't address the mixture of pollutants that can occur in a water body. And it also, it sets standards that have to be met, but those standards aren't necessarily going to be protective of all fish at all life stages. Another gap in protecting salmon is that the standards don't apply to all development that occurs. If you remember back to the graph that I showed you about how different land uses change the amount of stormwater runoff, you saw that stormwater runoff occurs even in forested environments. And so just managing stormwater based on the level of impervious surface is not going to get at all the effects. As well, there are exemptions in the permits in some of the larger cities. Development less than 5,000 square feet doesn't have to have any stormwater controls. In the smaller cities, development of less than an acre doesn't have to have any stormwater controls. So you can see across the Puget Sound landscape, there's a lot of development that doesn't have any stormwater controls. Another gap in protecting salmon is that the regulations don't address the core issue of land development. And this is the primary impact on salmon. As the land is developed, it changes all the things that we already talked about, the hydrologic cycle, the geomorphology of the stream, the water quality. And so if we're not getting a handle on how land is developed, we're not going to be able to adequately protect salmon in their streams. A fourth gap is that stormwater management practices cannot replicate the hydrologic cycle. Current practices try their best to minimize the peak flows on salmon, but there really is no way to adequately address the loss of groundwater inflow to the streams that's so important for summer base flows. And that's because this is how we try to manage stormwater. Typically, stormwater is managed with a detention pond where you put all the runoff from a site into a pond, you store it for a while, and then you release it at a certain release rate, trying to match a somewhat natural hydrograph of the stream. But because you're generating a so much greater volume of stormwater runoff, there's no way that you can completely match the hydrologic cycle. And there's no way that you can address those, get all the stormwater that historically went into the groundwater and contributes to the stream base flows back in the ground. So NOAA Fisheries, as a result, has spent quite a bit of time working on these issues, trying to improve stormwater management for fish. And in 1998, Chinook salmon were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And that kind of started our efforts. Shortly after that, we started working with several local governments, the big ones primarily, the City of Seattle, Tacoma, Everett, King County, Pierce County, Snohomish County, to improve their stormwater management efforts to better protect salmon. Also at about that time, Ecology, that's when Ecology decided to revise and update their stormwater manual. We spent a lot of time meeting with people from Department of Ecology, telling them of our concerns and making comments on their manual. As a result of Ecology issuing their 2001 manual, we decided to write our own guidance to use when we were doing consultations with other federal agencies, because we were concerned about the gaps, the things that Ecology wasn't addressing in their manual. In 2005, Ecology revised their manual, and as they were getting ready to issue municipal permits to the city and counties in Washington, we provided a lot of feedback on both their manual revisions and their issuance of their permits. And along about this time, the Puget Sound Partnership was also put together. The governor decided that it was time to put together a plan to have a healthy Puget Sound by the year 2020, and a group of people was directed to come up with a plan to achieve that. And here again, we felt that there were gaps in that plan that were not going to adequately protect salmon, so we spent some time providing feedback on that effort. And currently, we're working on the industrial permit, which Ecology is getting ready to issue. So when we think about recovery and what we want it to look like for salmon, for one thing we know for sure, it's not going to be salmon sitting around talking to each other in a group therapy session saying, "Hi, I'm Elmer, and I have problems." So we came up with what we think is an ideal stormwater management program. And it has seven different components. And the first one is to develop a basin or watershed plan. And this is important because this is where you make the connection between what's going on in the watershed and how the land is developing. So you would look at the full build-out conditions in the watershed, look at how that would change runoff in the watershed and what that means for stream flows and ultimately for salmon habitat. There's also an opportunity at this level to put limits on the amount of forest cover that you can remove and the amount of impervious surface that you can have in the watershed. And research in the past has shown that this is very important if you want to maintain stable stream channels. Another element that's important for an ideal stormwater management program is applying the standards based on biological and habitat requirements. And this means not only looking specifically at how the runoff is going to affect certain salmon life stages and certain critical populations, but also using biological standards such as the benthic index for biological integrity in addition to other water quality criteria to manage stormwater and protect fish. A third element is to have all land conversions and all development be subject to stormwater requirements in a watershed. As I mentioned earlier, there's a significant amount of development that occurs that's not doesn't have any stormwater controls on it at all. And cumulatively, over the whole landscape, this can be quite large. An ideal stormwater management program would also include replicating the natural hydrological cycle. And this can be done using what's called low impact development practices, or LID. And this has started to catch on a little bit slowly, but in 2005, the Puget Sound Action Team developed this guidance for low impact development, and it gives you ways that you can include this and different development levels at the site scale and a larger sub-basin scale or on a city block scale. And here are some examples. These are examples of things that you could do on a single family residence. You could have a rooftop garden with a rain barrel to catch the runoff off the roof. You could use that runoff water to water your garden, or you could disperse it out into your yard or other vegetated area and let it filter into the ground. You could use porous paver patios or driveways or sidewalks on your site so that water can get into the groundwater. You could use permeable landscaping. You can add amended compost to the soil so it's easier for the water to infiltrate into the soil. And here's an example of what the city of Seattle did in what they called their C Street project, or a street edge alternative project, where they took an existing city street and changed it to a single lane street that had swales alongside and infiltration basins on each side of the street with native vegetation and compost in the swales to trap the stormwater runoff. This is what it looks like from overhead. You can see that it's a much narrower roadway, so less impervious surface and much more area to trap the runoff. And this is what it looks like at the street scale. And the neighbors apparently really love how this looks because they like the natural vegetation look and less traffic on their streets. And they're also showing that it's been very effective in terms of reducing the quantity of runoff as well as the pollutants that run off the site. They're being trapped in the swales in the amended compost. The fifth element of an ideal stormwater management program would be to prioritize existing stormwater problems on a watershed basis. And that way you're looking at problems on a large scale and addressing the most important problems first. And this can be either stormwater problems that need to be addressed or habitat problems that need to be addressed as a result of those stormwater problems. The sixth element would be developing a research and monitoring program. The research is really important to continually update your knowledge about what's going on in stormwater management, as well as monitoring the effects on fish and fish habitat, as well as the effectiveness of the stormwater management treatment methods. And the last element of an ideal stormwater management program would be to use adaptive management to make improvements. So if you had a culvert like this that washed out, you would know what you were going to do to fix it, and you would be able to fix it in the way that best deals with the stormwater runoff issues as well as the salmon habitat issues. So, in closing, I just want to say, although we can never go back to a completely forested environment that had a natural hydrologic cycle like this, I think we do know enough about how stormwater affects streams and what we can do about it to provide much better salmon habitat for streams. Thank you very much, and I'm ready to take questions. Yes? Debbie.
Who maintains the swales in the city project, and does it rely on the homeowners, or does the city come out and maintain the landscaping that's done in the swales?
I think the homeowners do it to a certain extent, but the city comes out and does the kind of the big work. You know, they do the monitoring, and if the compost needs to be replaced, they would have that responsibility. But I think the homeowners can do the smaller things, like, you know, attending to the plants to make sure they're healthy and pruning and all that kind of thing. Yes?
In the screening on neurotoxins, do they look at algae and cyanobacteria and other organisms that could be involved in the salmon mortality? And the reason I'm pointing that out is that elements like copper, for instance, can damage certain classes and groups of algae and bacteria, but in that damaging, they may make a niche for some of the
right.
Play a role. So that was a question. Also, because algae tend to move off of temperature nutrients in daylight, the nutrient loading as well from the stormwater
Right.
When I see your retention ponds that fill up and then flood,
right,
I kind of wonder what's the biology cycle like in that pond, what's growing in that pond over the interim period.
Uh-huh.
And then when it floods over, you get this sort of flash of toxic things. Have you guys looked at that or thought about that? Or?
Yeah, I don't think that the scientists at the Science Center that are looking at the various water quality pollutants, and they're trying to look at the mixture of pollutants, so they might somewhat get to that first issue you were raising. But I don't know that they're really, no one that I know of is really studying detention ponds and how they're contributing to these adverse water quality effects. I mean, local jurisdictions do that at some level, but I'm not sure that they get to that level of detail that you're talking about. They would look at things like the water temperature. They would look at chemical constituents in the water, but they probably are not looking at the algae.
Yeah. I know that you've been working quite a long time on this. NOAA's done a lot of research
right.
on this. It's hard to find that research online. It's difficult to locate it. It's probably buried in journals, but I think the latest that you can get online is like 2003. It's good on the olfactory
right.
studies, but it doesn't do much to say the differential filtration.
Yeah. You know, I can send you, depending on what, if you're interested in a particular water quality pollutant, I have, you know, several pages of publications that they've done. On different water quality pollutants that I can send you if that would be of interest to you. Sometimes I know it takes a while for them. They work on these things for quite a while. It takes them a while to write up the paper, and then it takes it a while to go through review. And so it seems like if you're waiting for that particular piece of information, it can take a while. Yeah. Yes.
There's a lot of road pollutants and in edible plants and earth plants on the fertilizer pesticides. But what are some of the sources of these other contaminants, like copper and lead, and the ways that have been producing?
So where are the copper and lead coming from? Besides the agricultural lands? I'm not sure I heard.
Like the copper and all the metals coming from pesticides and things like that?
Some, but a lot of the copper is coming from like brake pads. So automobile use is anytime there's roads, we expect that there's going to be a lot of pollutants coming off roadways from the wear on the tires and also the brake pads, and then of course what the car is losing through, you know, the oil and all the lubricants that are used in the cars. The Science Center actually did a study that showed that you could predict where there would be problems in streams with pollutants for salmon if you had a high road density. So they're trying to make that connection between road density and pollutants being problematic. Yeah.
Are there any contemporary ways that you can say that people can reduce their impact?
Individuals on,
sure, yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, of course, you know, they could drive cars less. You know, they could not use herbicides and pesticides on their own property or use them very sparingly. They could, as I was showing you with the runoff from your own property, you can allow that to soak into the ground instead of running off your property. You know, you can have natural vegetation on your property, which also helps filter the runoff and keep it, you know, it transpires back up into the air so you're not having so much runoff. Those are some of the things you can do on an individual level. Yes?
Should the salmon that died first morning be smuggled down the water? Has anybody found an effective way of sort of mitigating the point source and non-point source pollution that causes pre-spawn mortality?
Well, that's part of what got the attention of the scientists at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center when this issue first came to light, was that these were creeks that had been restored. So theoretically, their habitat, their fish habitat was in good condition, but the fish were still dying. And so that's really what they've been trying to pick apart, is what exactly is it that's killing the fish. And, you know, the easiest way, without knowing the exact pollutant that's killing the fish, the easiest way to address that problem is to not allow stormwater runoff to go into streams, to provide infiltration of that stormwater runoff before it gets to streams. So you're not only dealing with the water quantity issue, but you're also trapping those pollutants in the soil layer. But to do that on a wide scale, you know, a widespread scale across a watershed, particularly in these already developed areas, would be, you know, a long-term undertaking. Yes?
So are there regulatory efforts afoot to change the stormwater, I guess, regulations? So are they trying to fix the sort of the lack of stormwater controls being compulsory?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that question, because I, you know, under the Endangered Species Act, federal agencies have to consult with us when they take an action that they think may affect fish. So we worked a lot with the State Department of Ecology because it was their stormwater manual we were trying to improve. But because they're a state agency, they didn't have to consult with us when they revised their manual. Now, there's a court case right now in front of the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court is looking at the issue of EPA delegating the responsibility to the state of issuing permits. And depending on how that court case turns out, you know, if they say that EPA maintains some responsibility to make sure those permits are adequate, then they would have to consult with us, and then I think we could probably make some progress in this effort, because EPA, in our past efforts with EPA, they have been more sympathetic to these issues about salmon. Yes? Well, it's as I was explaining, you know, we don't have as a federal agency working under the Endangered Species Act, we don't have a lot. We can't make state agencies or local government agencies do anything. But we do have the opportunity to consult with federal agencies when they take an action. So when we do consultations with federal agencies, for example, the Federal Highway Administration, when they're doing a new road project, we can say, we want you to follow, this is what we think an ideal stormwater management program is. We want you to do this. And to the extent they can, even though they don't have a watershed that they're developing, they're just doing a linear roadway, we would have them include those elements in their stormwater program. And if we're doing a consultation with another federal agency like Housing and Urban Development, where they're doing a big housing project, that's when we would have the opportunity to make that mandatory. Yes?
These swales and other bioremediation little devices, is there any uptake or removal of heavy metals from the system? Is it, you know, has someone quantified or qualified this?
Yes.
Capacity to remove pollutants?
Yes. Yes. That's. Oh, I'm sorry. He asked in the bioretention swales if there's uptake of the pollutants, uptake and removal of the pollutants, and if that's being looked at as an issue. And they are, the city of Seattle that's doing the C Streets project, they are doing that kind of monitoring where they're looking at the where all the pollutants are going, whether they're being absorbed in the soil or whether they're being taken up by the plants. And in some past situations where stormwater plans have included certain vegetation types that people know readily uptake these pollutants. And they're stored in the plant matter, and then sometimes that plant matter is harvested and removed off the site because it still has heavy metals, for example, in it. But that is an issue that's being studied quite a bit. Yes?
So follow-up on the sea streets, which I just think they look great.
Yeah.
What's the likelihood something like that could be? I mean, maybe this isn't right, but you're not the right person to ask, but, you know, are there plans to make that a reality in more streets, or is it still very preliminary? Do you kind of know what the progress of that is?
Well, the city of Seattle is looking at doing that in more of their area. That particular Sea Street project took place in northwest Seattle. And they're looking at doing it particularly in the Piper's Creek watershed because that's their focus. But this is one of the problems with stormwater management is that when you try and do things after development has already occurred, it's much more expensive than if you try and prevent the problem in the first place. So I think the city of Seattle, even though they're a very developed jurisdiction and they don't have a lot of opportunity for preventative actions, they are looking at places that they can apply that in other places throughout their jurisdiction. But they're also, you know, thinking about, are there other ways that we can do this that won't be quite so expensive? Yeah. Yes?
I was just going to say as a follow-up to that, and in relation to how you're talking about low impact development, there's the High Point
All right.
development that they're doing in West Seattle. I mean, they've included the swales as part of their landscape, and they also have a permeable sidewalk.
Right. And that's a much larger scale. I don't know the acreage, but it's much larger than just a block. And so it's really great to see the city, you know, looking at a, you know, starting it on a small scale and taking it to a larger scale where, you know, there's an opportunity to make a bigger difference. Yeah, thanks.